No, that's true.
Should we have him do it on video and then just face send it in?
Upload it to you from home.
Upload it up, Skype it in on the
only if I'm allowed to drink myself wine.
Just to
holiday time, people.
Around the dinner table, show us what you're eating.
Say hi to the fam. Hey.
Pretty pictures, Val.
That's what I do.
Yes.
So the focus of my research, you know, so far in my second year is macrophages. So the title of my research aim is maximizing. Skeletal muscle hypertrophy to resistance training. And the resistance training is going to be both in mouse and human or in vitro. So they're all kind of mimetics of actual resistance training. Some background on macrophages. I thought this sort of nice little image by Betzinger. So you have, these are regenerating fibers, but you can just kind of, the layout is similar to what you would see just in a normal fiber. So you have the myofibers, and then blood vessels, little satellite cells, and fibroblasts, and then the macs kind of hanging out just outside the fiber. There's some discrepancies between like mouse and human. In mouse, they kind of hang out in the epimysium, so they'll be like kind of in circles around these, like around bundles. Whereas in macs, like in humans, they're just like they're everywhere. They're in between. I would say there's probably a 3- or 4-fold increase in macrophages in humans and mouse based, but a lot of that could just be based on like how well the skin works or something like that. But what we see right now, they're in between the fibers, they're in the ECM, and they're kind of there to regulate ECM turnover. They eat cell debris, dead cells. Most notably, like in regeneration, you know, other stuff. They come in from circulation. There are resident macs that are there through development. But with regeneration and injury, it's cardiotoxin or blunt force trauma, they come in from circulation. They kind of secrete these cytokines that recruit or that cause satellite cells to proliferate, other cells to proliferate. They eat the damaged tissue, necrotic fibers, and debris. And then they're set to switch phenotypes to more of an anti-inflammatory state and secrete growth factors that promote differentiation of the satellite cells and kind of growth of the fiber and maturation of it. So with all that, we've shown that with resistance training both in mice and humans that we get a significant increase in macrophages per fiber. The scale's not the same, I apologize for that, but so you can see they're 0.05 to 0.1 in the mice. And ambulatory is just our regular cage dwelling mice, and then power is our progressive weighted wheel running. And that's 8 weeks. So we get about a doubling of max. And in humans, this is an elderly cohort that we're doing right now in our metformin trial. We see about like a 50%, so 0.2 to 0.3 after 14 weeks of just 3 times a week resistance training. So the problem is we know that they're important for regeneration, and we're starting to see that they go up with exercise, but we don't really know if they're important for growth. Most of the literature focuses on, you know, what they do to repair the tissue, but resistance training doesn't really cause a lot of, like, over damage. So what we're trying to kind of narrow down is, are they really relevant to that? And it's a little difficult at this point in time. It's not like satellite cells or PAX7 express. We know that's specific to satellite cells. If we knock out those cells, that the rest of the tissue isn't really going to be affected, like the brain or the heart or the liver. Macs are everywhere. They're in circulation, they're in your brain, they're in your heart. There's a knockout mouse where if you knock out macrophages, they get atrial fibrillation, or VFib, So it's just a little difficult to just say we're just going to knock out macrophages. And then they're constantly being resupplied by the bone marrow. So even if you are able to knock them out, 7 days later, they're right back to the normal levels. So instead of kind of trying to do what McCarthy Lab and what, you know, Charlotte Peterson have done is and just knock them out, we're going to kind of get a little more mechanistic and specific to what they're making. And most of the literature kind of suggests that they produce IGF-1, this insulin-like growth factor 1. It's a really potent anabolic stimulus. If you treat cells with it, if you treat myotubes with it, they get bigger. If you inject it into mouse muscle, it hypertrophies. And the pathway in which it's involved is really well characterized. It's this AKT mTOR. So you get an increase in protein synthesis and a decrease in breakdown. And so there's been a couple correlative studies in humans where they do cross-sectional area and IGF-1 levels. And you can see as IGF-1 gene expression goes up, you get increases in CSA. But whether or not macrophages make enough of this, we know they make it. There's a couple studies where they've used it to prevent atrophy in vitro. And then there was one kind of seminal paper where they did an injury model, knocked out IGF-1 and the macrophages using a macrophage-specific Cre driver and showed impaired regeneration. But nothing, and that's kind of the beauty of macrophages when you look at it with resistance training. No, everyone's, like, it's pretty well classified, characterized what they're doing with regeneration, but no one really knows what they're doing with hypertrophy. So even though, like, there's kind of similar models out there, just applying them to a gross stimulus is a lot different than what happens when you inject toxin into the tissue. So the purpose is to identify the mechanism, and we think this mechanism might be IGF-1. So I wanted to cross an IGF-1 flox mouse. So this has LOX P sites flaking exon 5, and then similar to the PAX7 Cre mouse, this is a colony stimulating factor 1 receptor. And that's fairly specific to macrophages. So it might be on some other immune cells, but as far as like muscle goes or anything like that, it's not really expressed. So the MER is an inducible one. So if we treat with tamoxifen, we can conditionally knock out IGF-1 in macrophages, in the bone marrow, in circulation, and in tissue. And that's just a 5-day tamoxifen treatment, and then we should get macrophage-specific knockout. And with that, we're going to do the progressive weighted growth training. So I'll have a wild type, probably just IGF-1 flox mouse, and the Cre given a vehicle treatment. And then my tamoxifen and IGF-1 macrophage knockout, and they'll both be subjected to 8 weeks of resistance training or power training. And we'll measure cross-sectional area and probably, you know, we'll confirm that IGF and or test and see if IGF-1 expression is lower in the tissue. And so my hypothesis with this aim is that it's not going to completely knocking out IGF-1 in macrophages isn't going to completely blunt the growth response, but it's definitely going to kind of mitigate it. So I think that it's important to really maximize the response to training, but not necessarily like it's not dominating or pivotal to the response. And then two, kind of going the other way around, we're going to take satellite cells from this IGF-1 flox mouse, isolate the satellite cells, culture them, treat them with a Cre adenovirus to knock out IGF-1. And then we have a nice little setup where we stimulate, differentiate them into myotubes, and then electrically pulse stimulate them to make them twitch and contract. And I've shown in human primary myotubes that I can get hypertrophy. So with that, the hypothesis is that if they don't have IGF-1 in the tissue, or in, if they're not locally producing IGF-1, they're not going to respond to the Easton. But macrophage-conditioned media, which potentially has high levels of IGF-1, might rescue this response. So no macrophage-conditioned media in IGF-1 knockout myotubes, no response. IGF-1 knockout myotubes with the macrophage-conditioned media in Easton, you get a response. This is like 300 stitched together images at 20x of the myotubes, of human primary myotubes that I've drawn up so far. So Easton versus no Easton, you can see there's about a 12 to 15% increase in diameter and size with this so far. So it's pretty well worked out and established. I mean, there's some variation on a theme of like whether or not I can do 8 hours or 12, but none of that really. Most of the response is pretty linear in that if you do a bout of E-stem, you get twitching, you get contractions, and then you let them rest, and you get elevations in protein synthesis, and then you get this kind of hypertrophy of the myotube. My last aim, I've been working with stellate cells from aged individuals for our metformin study, so I've isolated the stellate cells from their muscle biopsies, sorted them, purified them, and then grown them into myotubes. At baseline, once they're kind of mature, differentiated myofibers or myotubes, they have low IGF-1 levels compared to young. So I've compared them to young human muscle biopsy myotubes, and it's a pretty drastic decrease. And so, kind of staying on this IGF-1 theme, there's also the possibility of like adding macrophage conditioned media to it, but just initially to do the E-stem on the aged myotubes and see if they respond, and then see if there's a way to kind of rescue that with macrophage conditioned media. The significance of this is immune therapy, especially for muscle fiber or for skeletal muscle, is kind of growing. There's a lot of 3D scaffolding and bioengineering that's going on currently, and some of those scaffolds include macrophages. So volumetric muscle loss is a I think a little more applicable than like what someone might experience like from a snake bite. So they're basically generating these 3D structures of skeletal muscle that they've grown in culture, and then reinserting them and grafting them into the tissue, and whether or not macrophages should be incorporated into that is kind of a growing question. And then macrophages, I mean, you can inject, kind of similar like blood doping, you can inject macrophages into the circulation. If you have a signal from a tissue, from an active tissue, it's going to home those macrophages to it. So if those guys are important for growth. If you were to kind of do macrophage-related therapy and inject macrophages into a human who's training, an elderly possibly, you might reap the benefits of having elevated macrophage content and numbers, because they are going to home to the tissue.
All of your studies are sort of hinged on this idea that the IGF-1 mechanism is doing what you think it's doing. What if it's not? Like, what if you find in your first study that mechanism isn't actually, if I'm understanding it correctly, what if you find out that it's not doing what you thought it was doing?
If like the mechanism are making something else that's important for growth, or if
just
IGF-1...
Like if you knock, I don't, maybe I'm misunderstanding your studies, but like if you knock out the IGF-1, and you find that it doesn't do what you thought it did, then your other studies...
They're not interdependent, I mean, as interdependent as it seems, because
okay.
IGF-1 is only expressed by macrophages and by muscle and by other cell types.
Mm-hmm.
So just because the macs don't make it and nothing happens doesn't kill my other
animals. Okay. That was just my...
That's why I'm doing the myotube knockout, like IGF-1 knockout, because it's basically like you're taking a mouse that probably has normal IGF-1 levels in muscle, and then knocking out MAC IGF-1 and seeing if there's an interaction there but there might not be. But if you take a scenario or a situation in culture where there's no IGF-1 in the tubes, that so it's kind of like a promote with AIM-1 and then rescue with AIM-2, more than like just promoting it and then testing it in a different model, like in vitro. So.
Okay.
I kind of see what you're doing. The other thing would be is if they grew without IGF-1.
I mean, it's great if it all works out and it does exactly what you think it's going to do. But then you always have to think, like, well, what if? Because you don't want to get, you know, middle of your third year and then all of a sudden everything's interdependent and it didn't work out how you thought it would.
Yeah, no, I tried to make it as as non-interdependent as I could without getting too broad.
Well, I think with muscle, like augmenting growth and rescuing growth can be two separate pathways.
Yeah.
You know, and in either way, because of the correlative data that suggests it is augmenting growth, you need to directly test that hypothesis first. You know, and then more exploratory, more basic aims determine if you rescue. I don't think particularly hinge on the other one.
No, yeah, I spent a lot of time making sure it didn't.
It's important, even if it doesn't work out the way you thought it was, it's still something important to kind of...
Sure, but sometimes if they are super interrelated, and and then the first one doesn't work, it's like, well, now this study's pointless.
Right, I'm just saying, I think that in this instance, because it hasn't been done, all even negative data is still important.
I like AIM-1 because it tests something specific to macrophages that we know makes muscle grow, and then in AIM-2, even if AIM-1 isn't true, no one's really done IGF-1 knockout in myotubes before, so just doing that would be kind of cool, and then the E-stem, no one's done that, so all of those things are novel to the field and would shed some, you know, interesting knowledge and data. I like AIM-2. It doesn't really even have to go with the rest of it, but it's just kind of a cool thing to do.
I may have missed it. Did you talk about your protocol for the E-stem at all? How long or are you?
It's 8 hours right now. 12 volts.
Continuous.
Yeah. There's some studies that do a little more like intermittent, trying to like. Mirror what like actual human resistance training is,
right.
You only have so much time with the myotubes, like between like five. Like
you're trying to just get the best growth you can from.
They differentiate for like 5 days, and then you have like 3 or 4 days to do stuff with them at most. Otherwise, they just start coming off the plate. So it's kind of like a limitation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that much time, so it's I think to get a growth response. Doing something a little more exaggerated than what you might see a human or a mouse do is, but I mean, mice can run for a while, so not really that drastic.
In the E-stem, they stay on the disc pretty well with contraction?
Yeah, I've never seen like a difference between plates, because I always have a no E-stem and an E-stem every single time, just to keep the comparisons the same or consistent. If the tubes are coming off of one plate, they're coming off the other in the same fashion. They don't really, it's never, and I've gone 30 volts, and they still, so.
That's great.
I use a laminate coating, a really expensive laminate coating.
That was so cool. The picture looked like a Van Gogh type picture, didn't it? Remind you of the meat fields or something. You should submit that for the competition of microscopic.
If you wanted more of an exercise model for your map tubes, you could do that same stimulation in flex cell systems. Patrick Dine's done that in the past, and he's shown really good hypertrophy and growth in those mouth tubes when you stimulate and you stretch at the same time.
Yeah, we talked about that a while ago. It's just hard. They don't fit the, flex cells sell something like that now, but, like, we spent $15,000 on the ion optics setup, and then we have the flex cell, but they don't fit. In the well, so.
Yeah, 12 stimulators in the lab that probably fit flex cells.
Yeah.
So, if you ever want to do that, it's possible. You get better hypertrophy. You get more flex cells. What was your frequency that you use? You said you do
1 hertz.
1 hertz? Oh, just 1 second. Okay. What's the population of the macrophages in your preliminary data for the exercise? You didn't specify if it was M1 or M2s.
Then when I do the staining right now, So this has been like a whole big thing too that we've done in human and in mouse. When I do CD206, I can't get the F480 to work for some reason in mouse. It just looks really bad, which is like a pan macrophage thing. But CD206 stains all of them. And when I take those CD206 cells and sort them and then cytospin them down and stain them for CD68, which is like an M1 in mouse, they're all positive, like 95%. So it's mixed, but it might also be from the digest. Right now, like when they're in muscle and resting muscle or exercising muscle, they're all kind of mixed or M2s. And that's similar to what we see in humans, where it's like 95% or CD206, 163.
So how long after exercise were those data taken for those macrophages in mouse?
In mouse? Corey let them run the entire time. So I have some, I actually control some better controls this time, where they locked them in for a day.
So they moved the rest for a day after exercise?
Yeah. But that data set was, Corey never locked the wheels on them, so he just brought them up.
Most of those at once then?
No, they're all in twos.
Most of them
are kind of good, even though you didn't give them a day of rest, is that they were going for like 2 or 3 weeks at the same load.
Yeah.
So you think like if there wasn't a big influx of mass because of like an acute response. I don't know.
That's what I like. That's why I want to try and use the power training, is because sinus ablation, you get a huge influx of macrophages and immune cells.
Power training.
Huh?
I need power training.
Sorry. Oh. Yeah, that's what we call that. Between day 1 and day 7, you get this huge influx of macrophages, and then it kind of levels out. And it's hard to know whether or not, like, by day 14.
Are you looking at different time points?
I don't want to do a time course study. It's not. I don't really. Someone's already done an acute bout, and this is chronic. So they've done sinus ablation acute time courses, and then someone did a treadmill running. Pretty intense tremor running with mice, and then waited 24 hours and showed increases. So it's just, I thought about it, but it's a lot of mice just to figure out like when they come in, how long they stick around, if they keep going up.
How do you power a mouse
study? It depends. I think on we usually go in like increments of 5. Yeah. I think. If you do like 5, you see what your variation is. If it's trending towards something, you bump it up to 10. But it's pretty much.
So you don't actually have to run power analysis.
Yeah.
What the heck?
Because they're not a variable. For power analysis for human, it accounts for the variability.
You're like doing your pilot study as long as you're studying. You know, so like you're 5 for each group, see where you're at.
Yeah,
so like, could you, if you see your results are trending, could you just like now do 2 more and just add it to your data? Is that how you do it?
Yeah.
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 Because they're all genetically similar.
Right.
And
like,
the same age. So
you think, I mean, ideally you'll have like 8 hours of nice group, you know?
Yeah.
But that's really more like the viewers.
It gets dangerous when you get down to like 3 or 4.
I don't think we can do that with humans.
That's
genetically replicated.
That is a really nice thing about
it. Right, no, I get it. Wouldn't that be humane?
Right, of course it's very good. It also would be great if they all showed up and all the humans came to their follow-ups, but they don't do that either.
Did I ever?
Yeah.
Oh.
There's quite a few studies in the 90s and in the first part of the century that found even if you stimulate a muscle isometrically, you'll get some neutrophilia that will take place because it shows up in circulation, but sometimes it'll get with the muscle as well. And then the question is, are they communicating with the macrophages? If you knock out neutrophils, you don't get repaired muscle. So it seems to be a communication between neutrophils and macrophages is generation of muscle to share. It's shown that just like that in some of these other models of necrosis. So.
There's not a strong thing. I mean, I kind of looked at that before, and there's also a couple papers that show after chronic bouts of exercise, even with eccentric, you don't really get neutrophil infiltration
anymore. It depends on the model. Some animals, even in our eccentric exercise models, sometimes we'll find which pills and sometimes we won't. Sometimes it'll be just one photograph in there somewhere, which, because of the sterile inflammation, it's not, it's not the, the dog or the sepsis model. So we wouldn't expect them, but sometimes if you show up.
Yeah, my old PI came from a lab where they study a lot of neutrophils and showed, you know, did some hypertrophy stuff, but.
Actually, no, here, I'm just getting more than
that. What would that indicate? You saw neutrophils. What would that indicate to you?
Well, there's been, I think of only three papers that have ever talked about eccentric exercise and no neutrophils. And that's often in pain, but to get published because everybody has this dogma of sepsis. That you have to have a neutrophil before you have to have macrophage. I don't think that's the case of sterile inflammation, which is what we have in a closed exercise model. And so it's a conundrum because most people would look at neutrophils and say you're going to have horrible muscle necrosis and injury because these things are designed to do nothing but eat things and destroy things. Prior to macrophage involvement, that's for the whole dogma of 24 hour neutrophilia, and one macrophage is two macrophages. Stick around for a while. But that's, again, it's all based on sepsis. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say. And electrical stimulation is different than people.
Yeah, I don't love that dogma of infiltrating M1s and then M2s because there's already max there before, so there's so much.
So we don't know about
that.
Thanks, Doug.
Did you have a PowerPoint? Oh, you already got it.